the joint session of the 59th Wyoming Legislature budget session will please come to order. Senator Nicholas and Representative Simpson and Martin will please escort the Governor, Dave Friedenthal, and his daughter, Katie Friedenthal, into this joint session. The body will be at ease until the sound of the gavel. The joint session will now come to order.
Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, it is my pleasure to announce the following guests. The Honorable Clarence A. Brimmer, United States District Judge for the District of Wyoming, escorted by Senator Ross and Representatives Olson and Floyd Escobel. The Honorable Alan B. Johnson, United States District Judge for the District of Wyoming, escorted by Senator Ullman and Representatives Brown and Warren. The Honorable James Burke, Justice of the Wyoming Supreme Court, escorted by Senator Fecht and Representatives Bagby and Stewart. The Honorable Marilyn Kite, Justice of the Wyoming Supreme Court, escorted by Senator Perkins and Representatives Gingrey and Jorgensen. The Honorable William Hill, Justice of the Wyoming Supreme Court, escorted by Senator Mockler and Representatives Miller and Goggles. The Honorable Michael Golden, Justice of the Wyoming Supreme Court, escorted by Senator Sessions and Representatives Shepperson and Gilmore. The Honorable Jim McBride, State Superintendent of Public Instruction, escorted by Senator Coe and Representatives Davison and Kraft. Seated with dignitaries is Sharon Garland, representing the Honorable Joel Meyer, State Treasurer. The Honorable Rita Meyer, State Auditor, escorted by Senator Case, Representatives Simlick and Dirks. The Honorable Max Maxfield, Secretary of State, escorted by Senators Burns and Representatives Danz-Wanitzer and Meyer. The Honorable Barton Voigt, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Wyoming, escorted by Senator Jobe and Representative Korberg and Hammonds. His Excellency, the Governor of the State of Wyoming, Dave Friedenthal, and his daughter, Katie Friedenthal, escorted by Senator Nicholas and Representative Simpson and Martin.
To invite Father Thomas Conkleton to give us the invocation. Father Conkleton.
Let us pray. Almighty and eternal God, ruler and creator of the universe, when you made human beings, you gave us dominion over all of creation and a sharing in your power of governance. As we begin the budget session of the 59th Wyoming Legislature, we ask that you pour forth your abundant grace and blessing upon our governor, the secretary of state, the auditor, the treasurer, the superintendent of public instruction, the members of the judiciary, and the members of the House and Senate and all their support staff. Grant them a portion of your Holy Spirit as you did to King David, so that they may be endowed with knowledge, wisdom, understanding, and prudence. As King Solomon brought justice and prosperity to your people, grant that our leaders may do the same. Help them to work for the common good of the people of this great state of Wyoming, and let them have a special concern for the poor and the most disadvantaged in our land. We ask this in all things in your holy name. Amen.
Members of the 59th Legislature, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, I present His Excellency, the Governor of the State of Wyoming, Governor Dave Friedenthal.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Please, please be seated. Thank you. Thank you. Please. Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, members of the 59th Legislature, thank you for this opportunity to appear here today. I convey my greetings and those of my bride, who is not with me today. She is attending a First Ladies Conference in Washington, D.C., with regard to the program to keep young people free of alcohol. I will tell you that she did not begin this effort on an auspicious note as she left for D.C. yesterday. I suggested to her that she was going to miss my speech, whereupon she opined that she'd heard about all she needed to hear from me, a sentiment that some of you may share, but I appreciate the courtesy of your being here. I am not without familial support. I am joined today by my daughter, Katie, who is unfortunately a student at Colorado State University, a university that I might say is not nearly as generously supported by its legislature as you support our university. I would like to recognize some folks who are with us today. We have with us on my upper right, military department head and Wyoming Adjutant General, Major General Ed Wright. He is joined by the director of the Veterans. Go ahead. Let her rip. He is joined by the director of the Veterans Commission, retired Colonel Larry Bartlebart. Larry? Thank you. If you would hold your applause for just a moment, I want to talk about Captain Nissen. She is here today. She is the commander of the 1041st Engineering Company. There were 169 Wyoming soldiers from 41 Wyoming communities. They performed convoy security and over 700 missions in Tikrit, Iraq, and they returned home last October. We received word yesterday that they have been nominated for and will receive the Meritorious Unit Citation. It has been approved by all military commanders in the field, including General Petraeus. This is an award which should not be taken lightly. It means that this unit performs significantly above the level of other similar units in similar missions. The individuals within these units earn numerous awards, including at least 36 Bronze Stars and 36 Purple Hearts. Without starting a historical battle in Wyoming, it is my understanding that they are very close to becoming the most decorated unit in Wyoming National Guard history since the second of the 300th served in Korea. Captain, please rise and accept acknowledgement. We are also joined by members of the Shoshone Business Council. The Arapaho Business Council had planned to be here, but thanks to the traffic and some accidents, none of which involved the council, they are unable to be here today. But our friends, the Shoshone Business Council, are represented today by Mr. Floyd Phillips. Floyd? As you know, we gather here today with some change in our membership. Part of that necessitated by the passage of Senator Bob Peck and by Senator Craig Thomas, who was a former member of this body. We will miss them. We also miss Representative Tom Walsh, who resigned due to his illness, and he was a great friend of the military and a great friend of Wyoming, and we wish him well. Representative Liz Gentile resigned due to a career change. On a positive note, we welcome new members, Representatives Tim Stubson and Mary Hales, and Senators Bill Landon and my good friend, Senator Eli Bebout. Welcome. I would encourage the new members not to confuse their warmth of reception with the fact that they're going to vote with you. But my experience is the reception's always pretty warm, but the votes are a little thin and hard to get. We arrive here today at a remarkable time in the state's history. Those of you who recall the election of 1986, we had a gubernatorial candidate withdraw from the race, announcing that he had no intention of being the governor of Wyoming and preside over an economic wasteland. In 2002, the trick question in every campaign forum was, which tax are you going to increase to build schools and to build the new prison? My, how times have changed. We arrive here midway through a remarkable period of abundance in Wyoming. The gross state product has doubled in the last 10 years. Our unemployment rate remains remarkably low, and in fact, we confront a worker shortage. The subprime mortgage crisis, at least according to a recent publication from the Kansas City Federal Reserve, has by and large passed over Wyoming. In fact, they refer to the fact that Wyoming's remarkably low foreclosure rate brings down the average for the entire region. The projected general fund and budget reserve account balances for fiscal year 2009 are actually double the revenues that were available in 2003. We have a budget document originally recommended by the executive branch, adopted by the Appropriations Committee, which will be presented to you, which under most any definition is a generous and abundant budget. Not everyone agrees with that, and I'm sure that you're hearing from them. But I want to commend the Joint Appropriations Committee, and particularly the chairman. They listened for many weeks to the same presentations that I had heard for months. They heard the same information. They looked at the analysis of the budgets. And to some degree, the pleas for funding were more refined when they arrived at the Appropriations Committee. Once I had rejected them, then they went back and created new arguments on their behalf of the agency and on behalf of the interest group. While there are some differences between the budget that I recommended and the budget adopted by the committee, it is, by and large, differences that reflect changes of degrees in the points of a compass and not vast changes in direction for the state. And that is as it should be, not because I know everybody's sensitive about who gets credit for stuff, so I want to make real clear at the outset. It is not that the budget document from the executive branch was necessarily brilliant, although it was. The fact of the matter is that the budget essentially follows the contours of the state. It follows the contours of our economy, it follows the contours of our people, and it follows the contours of the available revenues. It reflects a commitment to continue many of the programs that have been adopted by this body and signed by me in the last few years, but it does not expand and create a great deal of new programs. It is fundamentally a budget that recognizes and continues the wisdom of past decisions. However, we continue to hear the discussion about budget cuts and the draconian reductions that were made. I would caution you that there is not a single budget that has been cut. What does exist is that there are a number of requests were not granted in full. No one got 100% of what they wanted. For them, that's a cut. From my point of view, it's still a pretty generous budget. However, I suspect that you have some of the same conversations I do with citizens, with interest groups who come in. First of all, they decry the size of the state budget, talk about spending, and then that's the initiation of the conversation. The closing part of the conversation is, but we need money for this other program, or we need this one added to, or we need it funded. I believe we have to resist those temptations. Although we are all in politics, and I understand that it is a difficult business, we have to recognize that while the talisman of politics may be not what have you done for me, but what have you done for me lately, what we need to recognize is we have done a great deal on the expenditure side for this state over the last few years, and I believe it is appropriate. We have more than enough funding to build upon what we have done in the past. We lack the funding, and we lack a real purpose in expanding on it a great deal. But we've done remarkable things with the abundance that this state has enjoyed. We have, for the first time probably in 20 years, been able to increase the savings rate on behalf of the citizens of the state. We increased the savings rate to 40 cents of every severance tax dollar that arrives in Wyoming. Goes into permanent mental trust fund, a rate the state has not seen for, I would certainly say, probably 20 years, a rate which we can be proud of. Because of the growth in the economy, we've made much greater investments in roads, cities and towns, and in the infrastructure of the state. And when it comes to education, no state can match Wyoming's dedication and funding for education, whether it's K through 12, the community colleges, or the university. We have much to be proud of and much to be confident in terms of the future. We've also adopted an ethic of stewardship and that stewardship finds its voice in our investments in the environmental protection area and in the enhancement and preservation of wildlife habitat. And while we've had our disagreements with regard to human services, I think in sum it is safe to say that we have had a practical compassion which has caused us to significantly increase and to guide our investments in the human services area. But we're at a different point today. We're at a point where the abundance we enjoy requires discipline. We have to exercise a discipline which in the past we did not feel obligated to do. We spent the past years addressing the deficit of several decades of no funding. We have built buildings, we've launched schools, we've built a university, we have added money to roads. We're at a stage now where we need to continue those efforts, but we need to have discipline about how we proceed. We need to have the discipline to recognize that even with this abundance, we cannot and should not fund every request that comes before us. We have to have the discipline, and this one I pray that you will hear, we have to have the discipline to reduce the increases in the standard budget. When you go to add things to the budget, please do it on the basis that it is not a continuing appropriation. Give us a chance to review next year whether it was the right thing to put into the budget. There are things that need to be done. I'm sure there are things that we left out. But if you stick it in the standard budget, it becomes the baseline, not only for this governor, but for every governor to come forward. We also have to have a discipline in our expenditures to respect that the marketplace for energy is changing. We must have the discipline to recognize that new technologies and new efforts must be promoted by the state. We also must have the discipline to recognize that we need to increase the efficiency with which we use energy. The cost of energy is going to go up and will continue to rise. There'll be some ups and downs, but the cost of energy is going to go up. We, as government elected officials, pay the cost. Just as people talk about their home heating bills going up, so do the states and so do the local governments. And we need to become cognizant that the best way to control those operating expenses going forward is to become more efficient about the use of energy. We also have to have the discipline to respect and facilitate the work of local governments, including cities, towns, counties, and special districts. We often focus only upon that which the state does, but one of the largest functions of the state, and particularly the legislature, is the transfer of wealth from the state coffers to the local governments and there for them to utilize to perform the basic service of the state. And lastly, we have to have the discipline to take seriously our stewardship obligation to this earth and more particularly to Wyoming. I want to talk first about energy demand. As all of you know, the demand for energy and the change in prices has been a generous benefactor to this state. And while we all know that energy demand in the United States and worldwide will continue to rise, it is not without its clouds. On a BTU basis alone, the state of Wyoming contributes 10% of all of the energy consumed in the United States. 10%. If you focus solely on domestic energy sources, Wyoming accounts for 15% of the energy consumed in this country. A bright future in a country that is destined to increase its energy utilization. But it is not without some problems. If this current recession is to deepen or were to deepen, you would find a softening of the energy prices and we would have a down dip. I would advise us to stay within the context of the rather conservative estimates that the Craig Group has generated with regard to revenue. And if you look at each of our resources in Wyoming, whether it's wind, uranium, oil, gas, coal, each of those faces some particular challenges going forward. For instance, with wind, a resource we're all very acutely familiar with this year, particularly anybody who comes down I-80, we understand that Wyoming has among the most remarkable wind resources in the entire United States. When you look at the maps that they've created with regard to wind resources, Wyoming has about seven areas that are just remarkable. There is a great deal of interest in the development of that wind resource. Unfortunately, for us to do that, we have to continue our efforts to make sure that transmission lines get built. I encourage you to continue to support the efforts of the Infrastructure Authority. I know that our office spends an immense amount of time working on various federal land plans to try to make sure that there are some corridors remaining for us to ship this energy out. It is not unreasonable to think of Wyoming as generating 6,000 or 8,000 megawatts of electricity from wind resources. Easy goal for us to reach. However, we have to get the transmission lines built. And coal, as most of you know, faces a series of transitions over the next couple decades. The most difficult of those is adapting to a carbon-constrained environment. Last month, in his State of the Union, the President committed this nation to strengthening energy security and confronting global climate change. This policy has significant implications for energy states such as Wyoming, particularly those states who produce coal. Many of the states around us and throughout the United States have developed their own carbon constraints with regard to the energy marketplace, constraints which imply and set a bar as to the kind of energy that they're going to accept, particularly coal-fired electricity. But perhaps most important is the fact that the financial markets, most recently three of the largest financial institutions in the country, have restricted their willingness to fund and to underwrite the construction of coal-fired electric generating facilities unless those facilities have accounted for the costs associated with carbon capture and carbon management. And when you figure that the boys with the money set the rules, they have now set the rules. And those rules include a vigorous attention to carbon capture and carbon sequestration. And so there are actions in front of you that are perhaps among the most important the Wyoming legislature has confronted in many decades. First off, I would encourage you to favorably consider two bills being offered by the Judiciary Committee with regard to carbon capture and carbon sequestration. These are bills that the committee has worked very hard on. I'm very proud of the work that they have done, and I believe that it will place Wyoming in the vanguard of carbon management. And it is appropriate that we be there. We are a state who is an immense producer of fossil fuels. We should also be a leader in the management of carbon and carbon sequestration. The measures are not without controversy, but I would urge their favorable adoption. The committee worked very hard, and I believe have given rise to legislation which is sufficiently narrow that it should be passed. Secondly, we are asking for a significant contribution out of the abandoned mine land money account. After taking $30 million off of the top to continue our ongoing reclamation efforts, we are asking that the remainder of it be allocated to carbon capture, carbon sequestration efforts, development of clean coal, and advancement of the School of Energy Resources. Most prominent among those is an agreement which we have, tentative agreement which we have struck with General Electric, which is for them to be a partner with the University of Wyoming and with the state of Wyoming in the development of coal conversion technologies and in the development of carbon capture and in the development of sequestration. These are significant efforts and ones that I hope you will support. It is a remarkable opportunity for Wyoming and its university to be able to partner with one of the largest, if not the largest, company in the world working on coal gasification, coal conversion, and coal technologies. It is going to be interesting. If we can put this together, the question is going to be whether we can develop the leadership at the university to be a good partner with General Electric in the evolution of this effort. I hope that you will look on the $20 million request for what it is, which is it is a down payment on the future of this state and a down payment on the future of the coal industry in Wyoming. As we go forward, you will see an effort within that context of the abandoned mine lands money by other people to attract it to many other worthy purposes in the state. There are lots of great things that didn't get funded. I didn't fund them. The Appropriations Committee didn't fund them. And people are going to come and say, as they always do, as they say to me and they say to you, you've got all that AML money. All I want is a couple million. I got all that AML money. All I want is 10 million. I would encourage you to have the discipline to say, no, we're going to focus this on the state's future and the state's future as it relates to the coal industry for two reasons. One is the tax money originates with the coal industry. It was paid by them. It was a tax that was adopted by them. And secondly, it is necessary that this state, given the absence of interest on the part of the federal government, that we work very hard to make sure that our coal is part of the energy mix of this country going forward. Right now, half of the coal, half the electricity in this country is generated out of coal generation. For that to remain, we have to work hard to make sure that our coal is suitable for gasification. Two reasons it's important. One is that all of the coal is going to sooner or later in this country probably be gasified before it's converted to electricity. When you gasify coal, we lose our low sulfur advantage. Because what happens is that all of the sulfur, no matter what kind of coal it is, gets pulled out in a separate stream. We lose the low sulfur advantage that accounts for much of our product and much of our product share in today's market. It's an important effort and one that I hope you will support. I also would ask that you reconsider a decision, I think maybe by inadvertence, if I understand it right, on the part of the Appropriations Committee not to authorize the State Loan and Investment Board to use a portion of its funds to encourage energy conservation on the part of the communities. What I would like is the capacity for the SLIB, State Loan and Investment Board, to use a portion of the money you've allocated. We don't need any new money. A portion of the money we've allocated as matching funds to encourage local governments to pursue energy efficiency. State Loan and Investment Board and the School Facilities Commission, we have all adopted policies with regard to future construction with an eye towards energy efficiency and trying to make sure that we use our money wisely. I would like the same opportunity through the SLIB grant to encourage them to do the same. I have just a few other small things that I'd like to take exception with Mr. Chairman and Mr. Chairman's appropriations bill, if you would indulge me. I'm not asking to take out any of the money for agriculture, Frank. We received a pretty substantial request from a number of people, particularly the health department, for a pretty substantial expansion in the emergency health care service network. When I looked at it, what I really concluded is we need to study it. I mean, it is an incredibly serious problem in terms of having particularly emergency services available out on the roads and in the workplace. Unfortunately, what we don't have is sort of a construct that will guide our funding over the next few years. I believe that in the future we're going to spend quite a bit of money trying to maintain the first responder emergency services network in the state. So I did not authorize that appropriation or recommend it. What I did ask for was $300,000 for the health department to map out for us what we're going to be doing over the next, I would guess we'll be at this for 5 to 7 years in trying to figure out how to make it work. I still believe that's the best course, that we should look at taking a hard look over how we're going to fund it over the years instead of sort of jumping in and saying, let's fund part of it now. And I would ask that you return that $300,000 to the budget. You know, there are a couple of initiatives outside the budget that I would like to talk to you about. One of them is a health care insurance pilot project. This proposal, which originates with a member of the Senate, is the first of these proposals that I've seen that I'm prepared to support. And this is a proposal for a pilot project to help deal with the underlying costs and improve the lives of Wyoming's working families. It is not intended as an expansion of coverage. What it constitutes is a public-private partnership among state government, working families, and employers to restructure the current insurance model. Secondly, it is our intent through this process not to limit what people can charge for high-cost procedures, but to limit the utilization of those procedures by having individuals take greater responsibility for their own health and their own health care. It has an emphasis on personal responsibility and wellness, and an emphasis on the prevention of utilization. It also is intended to create a better informed health care purchasing decision matrix for people involved in the program. What we hope is that instead of embarking on, as other states have done, a sort of broad universal coverage program which ultimately ends up, if not bankrupt, very close to bankrupt, that we would begin with a pilot project which focuses on taking people, informing them about proper health choices, encouraging those choices, and then rewarding those choices by allowing them to participate in a catastrophic insurance program. But it requires all of the elements. It is not asking for new funding. We expect that we can reach 500 people on a pilot basis with the $1.29 million that was previously set aside to do adults under the Kid Care program. This is an effort which is intended to reach part of the same target population, but to reach them in a way that is much more consistent with what we found in Wyoming, which is we really need to emphasize wellness, prevention, people taking care of their own health, and in that context, I would urge you to consider it. I also want to thank the Wyoming Healthcare Commission for all of the work that they have done. As you know, in this budget, I have allowed them to sunset in 2009, which is consistent with their statutory obligation. That commission deserves considerable credit, if not only for the things that they have encouraged us to do, but for the mistakes they kept us from making. By virtue of much of the work they have done, we have avoided some of the grander schemes which I think have afflicted policymaking in other states. They've also done a series of efforts that have been useful to us in terms of incremental efforts with regard to expanded care and particularly with regard to the healthcare professional database. I would ask, though, that when you look at that budget, hear them out. Their concern is that we ended up just cutting the budget in half. Apparently, they wanted some of the 900 series money to try to do some studies in the first year. I would encourage you to take a look at that effort. Secretary of State, as you know, is embroiled in a controversy with regard to some legislation he's proposing to deal with what has become generally recognized as a fraud-friendly business environment in Wyoming. These bills are bills that I supported and supported them early on, largely because of my experience as U.S. attorney, in which I became, frankly, more aware of how lax those statutes were than I had been before, and thought that they were sort of innocuous measures, that they would go through without any trouble. And recently there's this huge lobbying effort to undermine these bills. I hope that you will take a look. Secretary of State's on the right track. He has, I think, drawn the clear distinction between being fraud-friendly and business-friendly. For instance, we do not want to continue a circumstance that we have today, which is that Wyoming law allows for the creation of shell companies that require no presence other than a mailbox. There was a study done by the Department of Justice called U.S. Money Laundering Threat Assessment in 2005, largely spearheaded by the FBI and the Homeland Security. What they said is that Wyoming, our laws, offer minimal information requirements similar to offshore financial centers. Similar to offshore financial centers. Not exactly the proudest moment for our state. There are a couple of bills out there offered by the Corporations Committee. Senate File 26 would require a business to maintain an office at a Wyoming street address. All we're trying to do is put a face behind who these companies are. It would also require that the business have a registered agent who is a Wyoming resident. It does not require that there be a big fee. Does not require that we end up with the huge expense that you're being lobbied about. Take a look at these bills. All we're saying is that if you're going to use Wyoming's grant of corporate or other charter through the Secretary of State, that you will do it based on full disclosure. And my belief is if you don't have anything to hide, then this is a good place to do business. If you got something to hide, well, then we'd rather you didn't do business in Wyoming. I'd also ask you to consider the subdivision bill, Senate File 11. I can tell that you're getting nervous when we get to that one. As you know, this is a pretty controversial bill. What the bill does is encourage or allow, on a county option, counties to regulate development on parcels up to 140 acres. And we've been lobbied both ways about this. I'll tell you where I end up, which is that the county should have the option to go above the 35 acres, and if they need to or want to, go to the regulation of 140 acres. And I say this because I have watched over the years that as time has gone on, people have shifted the cost of their decision to purchase a rural lot away from themselves and onto the public till. What we have done through the State Loan and Investment Board and through the Wyoming Water Development Commission is that we have subsidized people's choices. And I think in a free market, which ideally we have, in a free market, we should all bear the consequences of the choices we make, particularly the financial consequences. And as you know, here's how it works. We go out, we set up some rural housing without adequate planning for water or roads or anything else. It gets put in place. Next thing you know, the water table goes down or there never was any water to start with. They come to the Wyoming Water Development Commission for a grant for 50% of the program, having established a water district. When they finish with the Wyoming Water Development Commission, they come over to the State Loan and Investment Board for the other half. And we have, in effect, underwritten the cost of a decision made by somebody else, a cost of a decision that is borne not by the individual, but by the public sector. Same is true when you form a fire district, and then they come to the SLIB, and they want a State Loan Investment Board, and then they want a fire truck. And if that doesn't sort of finish it out, then they go to the county and say, we want a road, and we want the county to maintain the road. Of all this expenditure I've talked about, where do they ultimately end up? They end up right here before this body in a request either from the SLIB or from the local governments for more funding. This is not a case of our extending or violating people's property rights. It's a case of our saying simply that you should be responsible for the true cost of the utilization of the property rights that you hold. We're not saying that you can't do it. We're just saying that if you do it, you can't offload those costs onto the public. Another bill which I will tell you I support, but I'm not convinced is essential for Wyoming citizens, but is essential to keep folks from moving in, and that's the dogfighting bill, or animal cruelty. You know, it isn't a problem in Wyoming. It hasn't been a problem in Wyoming, but we are now being held up all over the country as a safe haven for people who want to do dogfighting. It is a reprehensible activity, not one that is supported in this state, but we run the risk that if we don't make it a felony, which I think we should, we run the risk that people are going to say, you can't do it in 49 other states, but there's one place you can do it. Let's move to Wyoming. Let's put up a sign that says, in Wyoming, it's a felony. That activity isn't welcome here, so you don't need to bother to move to Wyoming to do it. Natural gas valuation, the issue that we've been up and down here. I vetoed a couple of bills. You guys have passed some. And I think we have finally arrived at a bill that I'm prepared to endorse. The committee will offer a natural gas valuation bill, which I believe reflects a proper compromise among the interests. Not a bill that it has all the characteristics of a bill that ought to pass. None of us particularly like it. It sort of reflects that it's probably the right compromise, and we should pass it, and we should get it done. Helium taxation remains an issue of concern to me. I know that the two chairmen of the Revenue Committee will offer a bill that will address the helium taxation question that was left open or opened by the recent Wyoming Supreme Court decision. As we watched it unfold previously in front of the committee, the bill draft invited criticism that it affected more than just helium. The revised draft is very narrow. You can read it from the outset. It is only about helium, and it is only about helium as it relates to severance tax, not to property tax, but to severance tax. Good, clean bill intended to address an issue that was opened up by the Supreme Court, which if you ask them, was opened up by the way we drafted the bill, but we won't go into that right now. I hope that you will take a look at it. There's also a bill with regard to from the Coal Bed Methane Task Force that's worked for 2 years that strengthens the state engineer's capacity to manage CBM water. Good bill, one that ought to be considered. I would ask that you remove some amendments that were put on in the committee when it came out. A particular amendment, which I believe restricts the discretion of the state engineer and reaches beyond anything intended by the members of the task force. The bill is intended to enable the state engineer to do a better job of managing. As it reads now with some of the amendments, it arguably reduces the state engineer's capacity. So I'd like to see the bill, but I'd like to see the bill without the amendatory language, and the bill I'm referring to is Senate File 46. Property tax relief. There are several bills out there. We've discussed this year in and year out, and I will simply say this. I believe that this state has sufficient funding for us to embark on a program to allow the elderly of our state to remain in their home. I'm not supporting a broad-based tax relief, and I've been criticized for that, but I'm very, very focused about what it is I want to accomplish. The people who I think deserve some attention in this state are the elderly who say to me, all I want to do is to be able to remain in my home for as long as I can. That's a particular set of people for whom I think the compassion of this state should be directed. The proposal that I offered includes amending the Constitution. I appreciate the fact that the Management Council authorized some additional hearings on the part of the Revenue Committee to consider that. I believe that for those of you like me who have been around this issue forever, when we talk about doing property tax relief, we always end up saying we'd like to do that, but it's not constitutional. The quickest way to solve that problem is to put it in the Constitution, give it constitutional sanction, and you can proceed to act to address the needs of these folks. I'm troubled by our continued focus on we have to means test it. Clearly, by not means testing it, some people are going to take advantage of it who may or may not, in the eyes of individual people, be worthy of it or merit it. But here's the problem, and we know this from our experience with the current property tax relief schemes. We know this from our experience with getting people to apply for the low-income energy assistance program, and that is that people in Wyoming, particularly at that point in their lives, they have their home, they have their memories, and they have their pride. And it does not include going down to the courthouse and telling somebody how much they make. It doesn't include a sort of the invasion of privacy that goes with that. And I would ask you that as you think about these programs, think about the fact that we're trying to help a particular set of folks in this state. We're not trying to do across-the-board tax relief. I lose on that every time because you say it costs too much. So, let's do a narrow one, and let's focus it on the people who are most worthy, but let's do it in a way that they'll take advantage of. This last scheme that we hatched and passed in here, it resulted in $144,000 of tax relief to all of the citizens in the state of Wyoming. And the biggest impediment is the requirement that they come in and talk to us about their income. I know not what it is you will do. I know that I will continue to talk about this, but it's up to you guys what you finally decide in the context of this body. I also commend to you the Education Committee's House Bill 17 regarding the Community College Commission's powers. The Commission has taken the position that it needs additional legislation to give it the ability to audit, develop uniform method of tracking dollars and students. I hope that you will give them that authority. It is not unlike what we currently do with regard to the schools. I believe that the Governor's Commission on Community Colleges undertook a significant effort, the benefits of which we will see going forward for many years. They opened the conversation about what is the role of community colleges going forward. However, I do not support all of their recommendations. First, I do not support the $15 million of added funds to the community colleges for their operating budget. The formula that has been devised has not been adopted. The formula that supports that $15 million has not been reviewed by this body, and the formula is one that is controversial even within the colleges. I also cannot support the request for $15 million in a fund for the community colleges to use for workforce training, in part because I cannot develop or ascertain a definition of how it would be spent. It falls into the category of there's $15 million that we think we could spend. We would like you to appropriate it. We'll create a committee, and it will be spent. I believe that both of those proposals merit consideration by the Education Committee during the intervening year, in the intervening year between now and the general session, and that they could be appropriate for revisitation at that time. I support a bill being offered by a representative to allow the state to loan to the community colleges 50% of the funding towards capital construction. They raise half, the state would loan them half. Pattern that we've adopted with regard to joint powers boards and a number of other entities. It simply needs to be expanded to include the colleges. I would do that with this caveat, which is to the extent those funds are used for dormitory construction, we should explicitly say that those dormitories will not be included in the major maintenance funding from the state. Those are revenue-generating facilities, and they should be able to operate on their own. I'm entirely comfortable with the numbers that the Appropriations Committee has developed in aggregate with regard to local government funding. It's less than what I recommended, but compared to the way you've slashed that budget in previous years, I'm just relieved, to tell you the truth. I think the controversial part for you and for me and for others is going to be the division of those funds. I think that the basic theory that they have adopted with regard to direct allocation community consensus, as well as some reserve for the State Loan and Investment Board, is sound. I continue to get lobbied about whether the data should be the 2000 census or the 2007 census. I've discovered that all I have to do is to ask which one gets your community more money, and then I know which data they prefer. What I would ask is that this is a big step for us in Wyoming, in that we have developed a rational formula. You can argue about the details, but we have in place the basic construct. And we have that data available to you at the beginning of the session, not at the end. We have the opportunity to begin to move in the directions being set by the Select Committee on Local Government Finance. I would encourage you to at least take seriously the need for a formula and the need for a rational formula that I think will be useful going forward. I am perplexed by this argument about whether or not we should make whole the communities for the funding that was lost with regard to the food tax. When we repealed the sales tax on food, the number of communities were diminished in terms of their sales tax revenues. In aggregate, we have increased the amount of money going out to the communities in excess of the money that they lost. But here's where it gets difficult, is that because of the way the formula works, if you are a community whose largest taxpayer was a grocery store or some kind of a food vending outlet covered by that repeal, you lost a greater amount of money than was compensated back to you by the traditional formula. I think the answer to that is to take the formula which was developed by the Revenue Department, allocate a portion of the sales tax revenues that you're sending back, allocate a portion of that based on the food tax distribution scheme rather than upon the traditional allocation formula. It doesn't change the amount of money that you are allocating, but it does change the equity and the maintenance of the promise that I think we made to those communities that we would keep them whole. Budget item that I'd like you to consider putting some money back in, and I've spoken with the chair of the Appropriations Committee, and that is the travel and tourism budget. Initially, we had a request in there in the capital construction for a welcome center on I-25. As most of you know, the welcome center on I-25 is essentially on the wrong side of the road and at an intersection that nobody can really access. So we're trying to establish a new entry point. The Appropriations Committee rejected that. A salutary effect of their rejecting that was that the folks who own the land have said that they will donate the land to us rather than have us buy it. With that salutary effect in place, I'm reluctant to say that the committee probably did something right. That's something I won't say very often. But the fact is, we now have a very, very different circumstance. For $3.4 million, without addressing the building question, we can go ahead, build the interchange. The interchange is going to be built anyway. Build an interchange with an eye towards accommodating a welcome center at some point in the state's future. What that means is go and bid it all at once. We can save some money. It costs about $3.4 million additional funds to either the Highway Department of Travel Tourism in order to make sure that we get that funded. The idea being we don't have to decide about the building, but we're going to eventually build one there. We should go and at the same time we do the interchange, we should use that money in the most cost-efficient way to prepare that interchange for the building so that you don't end up coming back in a few years, tearing up the pavement, rerunning the utilities, and starting the process over. So I would encourage you to look at that. You know, the problem in a year like this is that we've done a lot over the last few years. What we need to do is to stick with our task. And our task is to keep building on what we've done. Everybody, because we're in politics, you've got political parties and individuals who are saying, well, no, you gotta be looking for something new. You know, you gotta have the newer mousetrap. You gotta have the newer thing. You gotta expand the program. You have to have something that has your name on it. Has to be a House bill. Has to be a Senate bill. Can't do what the governor suggests because we can't let that happen. Bottom line is, all of those things are an evil and a kind of demon that keeps us from doing what's right. The greatest discipline we need in Wyoming, when we have the abundance that we have, is the discipline to focus on doing what's right. the discipline to make sure that when somebody comes to us, either from, and it's oftentimes our friends. I mean, they're lobbyists who are getting paid to lobby something, and they come and say, "We got to do this for me." We have to have the discipline to step back and say, "Hold it. Who are the shareholders that that person's lobbying for? They're lobbying for some company. It's an honorable profession. I've done it myself." But we have to have the discipline to step back and say, "Hold it. What is it that is at stake here? What's at stake here is whether or not we're going to do what's right. Not what our friends want us to do, but what's right." We have the same thing in the context of politics. The political parties are all scrambling to try to maintain some control over the American culture. And the political parties are getting weaker and weaker. And so what they do now is they come in and say, "Let's say something bad about the other guy." Not because the idea is bad, but because they're registered different than we are. "Let's say something bad about their idea." Not because it's a bad idea, but because, frankly, it's not our idea, or it might be a good idea and I'd rather it was mine. As you know, I've become absolutely unabashed at stealing good ideas any place I can get them. And I usually try to even admit it. But what I'm arguing for is a different way of doing business. Because I think what's going on in this country and in this state is that people are beginning to wonder about not the decisions we make, but the way that we make them. And what it is that turns out to be important to us when we weigh the future and we weigh those decisions. We had this conference in January in Casper, in which we decided that, it's the second term. We'll go ahead and touch the third rail of Wyoming politics, and we'll have a conference about planning. Frankly, I expected that we'd get a modest attendance, maybe 100, 125 people. We ended up with 525 people. The room was packed. We had to turn people away. We had to extend their participation in it. And the most interesting thing about it was that a lot of people there were not the usual suspects, the usual suspects being you and I and the folks who are always at these things. Second thing that was unusual was the degree of energy people had about thinking about what this state's going to be in the future, thinking about what it is we want for ourselves and for our children. I expected that we would get run out of town, that the notion of talking about planning and zoning and the rest of it, we would suddenly end up in a difficult circumstance. Quite the contrary. But I did get a couple of messages. One is they want it to come from the bottom up. They want it to be driven by the values that they possess, not the values that I possess or the values that this legislature possess. The counties, the jurisdictions in this state, have very different visions about who they're going to be and how they're going to get there, and we need to support that. The second message I received, and received quite clearly, is that there is a concern about the way we are thinking about the future, that we are focused not on the issues that they're concerned with, which is housing, environmental protection, what kind of a job they're going to have, and the things that account for their daily life and health care, but they look at us and wonder, exactly what is it you people are doing down there in Cheyenne? We will be approaching you both in this session and later about participating with us in an effort to do some form of an Envision Wyoming, to draw upon that energy and to draw you into that. And when we do, we will be asking you to set aside the traditional sort of values and stereotypes we bring and to sit down and talk honestly about what this state could be and what we hope it will be in the future. We owe that to ourselves, we owe that to our children, and we owe that to future generations. I'm delighted that you would entertain me today. It's always a pleasure. I look at it, and this is the sixth time I've been before you, and I'm delighted by that. I expect that I will double that number before I am done. Just checking to see if you're still awake. Nancy and I look forward to seeing you at the house for dinner through the session. I wish you Godspeed with your work. I ask that we exhibit the courage that we enunciate as we travel around the state, that we address these issues with vigor, that we address these issues with energy, and that we arrive at a result that is good for us and for the citizens of the state. Thank you very much.
Friedenthal, on behalf of the members of the 59th Legislature, thank you for attending today, and thank you for your message. We appreciate it very much, sir. Members of the 59th Legislature, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, I now present the Honorable Barton Voigt, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
Thank you very much. Mr. Speaker, Mr. President, Governor and Ms. Friedenthal, members of the legislature, fellow judges, friends and fellow citizens of Wyoming, I especially first want to thank you legislators who came over to our breakfast this morning and pretended like you were looking forward to hearing what I had to say here today. Won't name any names, but with that encouragement, I did go back to my office and add about 20 minutes worth of stuff to tell you about. I didn't want to disappoint anybody. Truthfully, it is my honor and it's my great privilege to appear before you the second time now to report on the state judiciary. It seems like it was just such a short time ago that I was here, and I'm afraid that short time perception arises more out of my getting older than it does out of that old adage that time flies when you're having fun. We've been busy. The other justices sitting back here, I can tell you, lied to me about this Chief Justice business when they handed it to me for a turn. There's a lot of work. There's no more time to do that work. No extra pay, no state car, no nothing. Just a lot of meetings. And so many meetings that I'm not sure I'm not actually getting any real work done anymore. I'm not really comparing myself to Abraham Lincoln, but I'll use one of his anecdotes in telling you what it's like sometimes in this job. In the depths of the Civil War, when things were not going too well and the outlook looked grim, the outcome was still in doubt, someone asked Lincoln what he thought of being president. And he thought about it for a while, and he said, "Well, it's kind of like the fellow who was tarred and feathered and ran out of town on a rail. When asked how he liked it, that fellow said, 'Well, if it weren't for the honor of it, I'd just as soon walk.'" Sometimes that's what it feels like. But if that sounded like a complaint, it really isn't. I love this job. I can't think of anybody I'd rather have doing it. I find that I trust myself implicitly, and I have utter confidence that I will do the right thing. Now, down to some brass tacks. When I spoke to you last year, I had to report that five state justices had resigned soon after I became chief. I assured you there was no connection between those two events. I feel more comfortable in saying that again this year because we made it almost a full year. We made it till December 21st before we lost another state justice. At that time, District Judge Nicholas Kallikathis from here in Cheyenne announced that he would retire effective in March. And the Judicial Nominating Commission is in the process right now of selecting names to send to the governor. We had the phone call last week. We're meeting on Friday, and the name should go to the governor this Friday. I want to thank Judge Kallikathis for his many, many years of service. He's been a district judge since 1987. Not to insult the rest of us still on the bench, but I think Judge Kallikathis was the intellectual light amongst us, and he will be sorely missed. I want to say something that the governor's already mentioned, and speaking of folks who are sorely missed, I can't help but notice the absence of Natrona County's Tom Walsh, and if he's listening, I want to wish him well on behalf of all the judges of the state of Wyoming. Tom is a man who has dedicated his life to serving the people of Wyoming, and that means from Vietnam to Mayor of Casper to the state legislature. And one thing I can't fail to get in here, from one Hot Springs County High School graduate to another, I was a little bit concerned about the diminishing influence of Hot Springs County in the legislature with Tom's leaving, but Representative Stubson assured me on Friday that he actually spent several years in Grass Creek as a toddler. So is that good enough? That'll do. Okay, we'll take that. I think that's probably enough guidance for him. I suppose the next thing I should talk to you about is the progress, if that's the right word, across the street with our remodeling of the building. I can start by saying that you will not recognize the building the next time you go in it. It's been gutted top to bottom. It's going to be completely different. Unless folks are lying to me, I think we're still on track time-wise. We're hoping to get back into it around October. And when we do get back in it, we'll have some kind of special ceremony and invite all of you there. We believe that we have spent the state's money wisely, with the result being a very stately building, but a very utilitarian structure that will serve for many years to come. Now, when I say we have spent the state's money wisely, what I really mean to say by that is that the Construction Management Division of the Department of Administration and Information has prevented us from spending it as we would have liked to have spent it. The relation of the Construction Management Division, in case you don't know, to the rest of the agencies of the state is a very loving, paternalistic relationship, sort of a father-knows-best relationship. I want to give you an example of the type of relationship we have with them, and I could only think back on my youth. When I was growing up, I had a friend whose father was a very loving and caring father, and he took him out onto Boyson Lake several times to help him learn how to swim. And he would gently lift him over the side of the boat and place him gently in the water. And I asked my friend how things were going, and he said, "Well, you know, the swim to shore isn't bad. It's getting out of that damn gunny sack. That's kind of tough." Well, we've had a few gunny sack incidents with the Construction Management Division, but for the most part, those difficulties have been resolved. Of most concern, and you know about these, have been situations where we thought something was going to be in the contract, in the budget, and it wasn't, and we've had to come back and say, "Look, we need this. Can you fund this for us?" Fortunately for us, if you remember last year, the overestimate in the library shelving cost gave us some extra money to help cover some of those things. We just had a little fright about 3 or 4 weeks ago. The server room, where we have all these servers that for all the computers of the whole state judiciary, turned out to be just a little bit smaller than for the servers it was designed. And we had some difficulties, had a big meeting about that, talked to everybody involved, and I think we've reached a resolution of the problem, which just involves hiring smaller people. But we're going to have room in the server room without having to tear the walls out. The other major project that you funded for us in the last couple of years I wanted to talk about was our electronic case management system. You may remember that the Supreme Court lacked any kind of modern case management system, electronic capabilities. I can say today, with a certain amount of pride and no humility whatsoever, that our new case management system is up and it's running. It has the court's docket available to the public on our website. And at, I've got to get this right, 3:29 p.m. on Wednesday, January 2nd, the court received its first electronically filed brief. We're still in the experimental stages of e-filing, but we expect to have it available to the entire Wyoming State Bar by the end of the year. We are told by the people we're working with, we call them C-TRAC, they changed their name, I'm not sure exactly who they are, that when that happens, we will be the first state Supreme Court in the country to have a fully integrated docketing, case management, and electronic filing system. For that success, I want to thank our Clerk of Court, Judy Pacheco, and our database manager, John Capron, for their hard work and dedication. And I also want to thank this body for having the foresight to get us into the age that we need to be in. Next up in that regard is the much more complex concept of electronic filing in the trial courts. We've been thinking in that direction, and I expect that once we do that, we will do it once again as we are doing in the Supreme Court, starting out with criminal cases, because there are far fewer lawyers involved and far fewer pleadings. We're also studying at this point the possibility of requiring the electronic filing of transcripts, that's court reporter transcripts, before we get into these more complicated areas, and that's because court reporters already prepare their documentation electronically, and so it's not that much of a transfer. We are purposefully moving very slowly because we have heard so many horror stories from other state jurisdictions that spent lots of money on projects that were later junked because they were not properly planned and did not do what they were supposed to do. I should add that we are not climbing this technological mountain simply because it's there. We are doing it because of the tremendous advantages that it offers, because the world is headed in that direction whether we like it or not. Perhaps I can give you an example of some of the potential in this situation. For a typical Supreme Court appeal, we receive a brief from the appellant, a brief from the appellee, then a reply brief from the appellant. The clerk of district court then sends us the record, which consists of all the filed documents from the trial court docket, plus copies of the transcripts from any motion hearings and the trial. We read the briefs, we hear oral argument, then prepare an opinion using our notes from oral argument, the briefs, and the record. Very often the parties have cited to dozens of cases, and the papers and transcripts contain thousands of pages. Historically, we've been required to go to the case books to find the cited cases and to go to the paper record to find the facts relied upon by the parties. Electronic briefs eventually will give us the ability, through the hyperlink process, simply to click on the case citation or the page citation and go directly on screen to that case or to that page citation without going to the paper. That will be a tremendous savings of time and effort. And when we get down to doing that in all the trial courts, it'll be a savings for everybody. This discussion of technology leads me into a couple of related subjects. First, I have to say that we're struggling. We really are with the money that you give us to keep all of the state judiciary's technological needs met, and they're more than you might think. Some examples, part of this is left over from last year. The circuit court's old and untrustworthy tape recorders have all now been replaced with digital recording systems. We're also developing video arraignment capabilities, especially in the busier jurisdictions and those with jail facilities that are separated from their courthouses, where prisoner transport is both a security risk and a financial concern. The best example of that, of course, is Rollins, where transporting prisoners from the penitentiary to the courts is difficult, and it's far better to allow them to appear through a video arraignment than transporting them. Next, I want to talk to you about the Judicial Systems Automation Account. For those of you not familiar with the Judicial Systems Automation Account, it was created by the legislature in 2000 as a special revenue source for, and I want to quote this phrase, quote, the purchase, maintenance, and operation of computer hardware and software to enhance the communication, records, and management needs of the courts, end quote. Two statutes require the district and circuit courts, and another statute allows the municipal courts to collect $10 per civil case to be deposited into this special fund. Now, our first attempt to manage the expenditure of these funds was a committee called the Judicial Technology Task Force, the JTTF. The method of operation of the JTTF was basically a grant system. In other words, the JTTF would receive proposals for particular individual projects and then would recommend to the Board of Judicial Policy and Administration, the BJPA, whether to fund the proposal. Well, during this past year, I sat down with our court administrator and information technology staff to discuss the effectiveness of this methodology. That is, the somewhat sporadic funding of special requests, what I call pet projects, with no central focus or plan. Generally speaking, we were concerned that we were expanding into too many areas with too little comprehension of where we were going and without first having our own house in order. The result was the creation by the BJPA of a new court technology committee comprised of the Chief Justice, the court administrator, a district judge, a circuit judge, a clerk of district court, and the Supreme Court's two main computer gurus. That committee has abandoned the old grant system and will operate in the future under a more centralized plan as contemplated by the statute I read you earlier. Our goal is a technological structure within the judicial branch of government that is uniform from top to bottom and that provides instant access to our information to all court users, including especially the law enforcement agencies that most need to be kept up to date. Right now, one of the frustrations in this database management is the question of how to integrate the state's municipal courts and municipal ordinance violations into the system. Okay, finally, getting out of the technological sphere, I'll update you on a few other things that are going on in our branch of government. We can't do entirely without statistics, so I'll tell you that in 2007, the Supreme Court published 208 opinions as compared to 162 in 2006. Now, we can't account for this dramatic increase, and we hope it's temporary. But with five justices, 200 opinions means that each justice wrote around 40 opinions last year. And I have to back off a little bit and give credit where credit is due. I will tell you that Justice Kite actually authored 50 opinions this year, which is a truly astonishing number if you've ever tried to do this. In case you can't do the math, that's slightly more than four per month. An opinion can be anywhere from 10 to 100 pages or more, but is usually somewhere between 25 and 40 pages. If you imagine doing that four times a month, on top of reading maybe 50 briefs and hundreds of pages of trial court record, you'll get an idea of what we do across the street. When I was working on my master's degree, I had to write a master's thesis, and I think it ended up being about 98 pages. That took me 2 years, and I thought it would kill me. And I would love to have that luxury today. One other thing, rather than give you lots of trial court statistics, I asked the court administrator simply to compare last year's total filings in the district courts with the number of filings 10 years ago. It turns out that the average increase statewide in filings during that period is 17.4%. I'm sure the statistics for the circuit courts are very similar. A couple other events and developments. In September, just prior to the state bar meeting in Jackson, the court held oral argument at the high school in Star Valley. We try to do that at least once a year. We call them the road show. Sometimes we get them done twice a year. We like to do them in the public schools, especially to let the school kids get a feel for what the Supreme Court does, as opposed to what they see on TV. These local appearances are quite a hassle, but we repeatedly are praised for going out there, and invariably the reception is very good from the public. The week after the state bar meeting, we met with the Commission on Judicial Conduct and Ethics, and that is our constitutional oversight body for the judicial branch. We met with them just to answer any questions the commission might have and to get acquainted with new commission members. Two specific things I will mention about that meeting. First, we agreed to create, and we have created by court order, a special committee headed by the law school's professor, John Berman, to study the American Bar Association's revised model code of judicial conduct. That committee will recommend to the court whether Wyoming should adopt the revised code. We adopted the current code in 1990. The ABA, the American Bar Association, has revised the code largely as a result of litigation in states that have contested judicial elections. Those states, unlike Wyoming, have problems with what limitations can constitutionally be placed upon the speech of persons seeking judicial office, and also problems with the question of judges seeking financial contributions to run election campaigns. It is not a pretty sight when you have competing interests financially influencing the selection of judges. Wyoming is very fortunate not to have that problem. The second item about the Commission on Judicial Conduct and Ethics that you might find of interest is that the Commission has established a website for the purpose of educating the public on the Commission's role and to make it easier for citizens to file complaints against judges. I wasn't sure I wanted to mention that one, but it's there. I'll let you know later on whether that's a good thing or not. While I'm talking about judicial conduct and ethics, I'll also mention that the court has entered into a contract with a professional substance abuse counseling firm to make sure that such services are available, either voluntarily or involuntarily, to judges who may suffer from a substance abuse problem. The judiciary followed the lead of the Wyoming State Bar, which contracted for those services for all the lawyers in the states. A few other quick comments. You will notice that one of the specific requests in the trial court budgets is for the payment of interpreters for non-English-speaking defendants in criminal cases. Curious as to just what that might entail, I emailed all of the clerks of court and asked them to report their use of interpreters this past year. Here are the tabulated results. Our courts hired Spanish interpreters 43 times, sign language interpreters 14 times, Russian interpreters 6 times, Vietnamese, Chinese, and East Indian interpreters 3 times each, and the following languages 1 or 2 times: Cambodian, Ukrainian, Hungarian, Polish, Serbian, Croatian, Romanian, Korean, Amharic, Arabic, Samoan, and Basque. Now, I bring this up because it is not a minor issue. Language barriers in the courtroom raise questions of constitutional due process of law, of constitutional access to the courts, and of compliance with the Federal Americans with Disabilities Act. The National Conference of Chief Justices has identified the need to provide language interpreters as one of the top 10 problems facing the judiciary nationwide. Cost is a big factor, as interpreters must be provided not just for court appearances, but for conferences with defense counsel and for statutorily mandated procedures outside the courtroom, such as substance abuse and sexual abuse evaluations as part of the sentencing process. The next big question in regard to this issue is whether standards, testing, and certification are on the horizon. This problem is not going to go away, and it's going to get worse before it gets better. Now, you will undoubtedly want to know how the Guardian Ad Litem program that you established in 2005 is faring. The program is administered via contracts among the Supreme Court, where the funds are housed, the district courts, where the funds are used, the counties, who pay a proportionate fee of guardian ad litem fees. Now, we submitted a detailed report to the Joint Appropriations Committee and the Joint Judiciary Committee on October 29th. That report should be available to each of you if you're interested in the details. Suffice it to say for now that the state's share of the cost of this program jumped from $698,000 in fiscal year 2005-2006 to $1,064,000 in fiscal year 2006-2007. The program has not been without its problems. The accounting and payment system is complex because it involves attorney reporting, district judge oversight, county payment, and Supreme Court reimbursement. Furthermore, we've been receiving anecdotal reports from the counties that the availability of this pot of state GAL funds has greatly increased the amount that it costs counties, not just for GALs, but for counsel for indigent parents. You will notice as you proceed through the session that the governor, the Supreme Court, and the Joint Appropriations Committee have recommended that the GAL program be moved from the Supreme Court into the State Public Defender's Office, an office which specializes in hiring specialized attorneys. We hope that you will support this effort to make this system more efficient. Like last year, I'm checking my watch. I'm trying to get through this without boring you all to death, but I keep finding these things you probably ought to know about. You're all aware that courthouse security is an issue that is not going to go away anytime soon. We want to have something in place before, not after, disaster strikes. There's a committee functioning now to study all of the counties to determine probable needs in the county-owned buildings. One of the main purposes of the new front access to the remodeled Supreme Court building, in addition to handicap access, is to provide a security checkpoint at the front of the building rather than scattered throughout the building. We first looked to the possibility of utilizing highway patrol troopers as security officers. That is apparently not going to happen, so we are asking you, and you'll see this also in our budget, we're asking you to allow us to fill the Supreme Court bailiff position. That position has been provided for by statute, actually, since 1899. As Governor Friedenthal indicated earlier to me, that would keep the troopers out on the highway where they belong. While we await improvements in the provision of security, we have asked the National Center for State Courts to provide training for all judges and court employees on what to do in case of such emergencies as hostage taking and the appearance and use of deadly weapons. Invariably, the courts deal with people who are troubled or who are in trouble, and the potential for violence always is there. We believe we have a duty to our employees to protect them as much as we possibly can. Okay, now a couple important things. The judicial branch is seeking pay increases in a couple of ways. First, we're mirroring the executive branch by asking for a 4% per year increase for employees during the upcoming biennium. Secondly, there's separate legislation proposing a judicial pay increase of 6% for the first year and 4% for the second year of the biennium. The 6% figure came from last year where the judges missed out on a 2% raise that was given to other state employees. It's our understanding that this percentage approach, basically matching the percentage for the rest of the state employees, is your preference. We find it's a satisfactory way to keep judicial salaries at a reasonable level, both as compensation for the work done and to attract competent applicants, and so that's why we've been coming back that way lately. Now, of equal concern to the judiciary is the state of the present judicial retirement system. And out there, I'm sure every single one of you have heard from us in that regard. In a nutshell, the situation is this. Several years ago, you created a new judicial retirement system to replace the existing unfunded system. Most sitting judges opted into the new system, and all judges appointed since then are automatically in the new system. However, an unanticipated problem was uncovered in the new system when District Judge Terry Rogers left office. He had opted into the new system, so his retirement benefit was calculated under the, quote, actuarially sound, unquote, provision of that act. Much to everyone's surprise and Judge Rogers' distress, the calculated amount was much less than the amount he would have received under the old system. It is our firm belief, the state judges of Wyoming, that you never intended that result. Encouraging us in that belief is the fact that you subsequently adopted legislation allowing Judge Rogers to opt back into the old system so that he would not be cheated out of the retirement that he had already earned. Now, legislation designed to implement this unintended consequence failed last session for reasons of which we're not sure. This year, we are asking you to give favorable consideration to similar legislation so that Wyoming's judicial retirement system will reflect the realities of judicial tenure in this state and will provide fair and reasonable benefits to retiring judges at an appropriate age. Now, I'm getting close to done. This next issue I want to discuss with you does not touch the entire judiciary, but it's of vital importance to one judicial district, and that is the creation of a district judgeship in Pinedale. Sublette County is part of the 9th Judicial District, which also includes Teton County and Fremont County. Historically, the district judges from those two counties have covered Sublette County's workload by traveling there as needed. Statistics from the new caseload study that you funded last session, plus the realities on the ground in Sublette County and in the 9th Judicial District, show that that minimal coverage is no longer adequate and is not fair to the people of Sublette County. The facts are these. There is one district judge in Teton County with an identified need for 98% of a judge. That's basically a one-to-one ratio, leaving no time for that judge to cover Sublette County. There is also one district judge in Fremont County with an identified need for 130% of a judge. In other words, the judge in Lander not only lacks the time to cover Pinedale, he cannot even be expected adequately to cover Fremont County. Finally, we all know that Pinedale is in the midst of an economic boom based on energy development that has fundamentally altered the nature of that community and all of Sublette County. Sublette County's $4.4 billion now accounts for 21% of the state's assessed valuation. Sublette County pays nearly 20% of all taxes paid into the state's coffers. From 2000 to 2006, Sublette County's population grew by 24%. All of this has created a great deal of pressure upon the judicial resources within the county. For instance, the budget of the Sublette County attorney, which was once the proverbial drop in the bucket, totaled $939,339 last year. The office now has a county attorney, four deputies, six secretaries, and an investigator. The caseload study completed last year already showed the need for a district judge in Pinedale at 42% workload capacity. When combined with the 30% shortage in Fremont County, the numbers show that today, even if growth stopped, which it won't, the 9th Judicial District is right now short 72% of a district court coverage to which it's entitled. In 2004, 200 cases were filed in the district court in Pinedale. In 2007, that figure had leaped to 340 cases, almost double. Now is the time to do the right thing and create a position in Sublette County to handle that workload that is surely going to just continue to grow. It will also enable somebody to help out in Fremont County. Now, the good news is this. I drove up to Pinedale in January to meet with the county commissioners, to meet with the clerk of district court, and to meet with Judge Young, who came over from Lander. We toured the already remodeled county courthouse, which is clearly sufficient to house a district judge, and the commissioners assured me that the very limited amount of work required to make a law library into two offices would be done before a judge was ever selected. I told them that after the legislature's recent experience with a certain other county that I won't name, promises and assurances would not suffice. We had to see hammer and nails, and I don't think there'll be any problem in that regard. Now, I have to say that I like to come over here and talk to you folks, tell you about the judicial branch of government and what we're doing, and keep you informed of what's happening over there. I don't like to come over here and ask for money like I'm some kid that spent all my allowance and I still want to go to the movies. That's what it feels like sometime. But that's the way the constitutional separation of powers works. You folks are in charge of the purse strings. I know that right now everybody is worried about the economy, the possibility of a recession. Even my dogs are worried about the economy. The price of Alpo has gone up to 99 cents a can, which is almost $7 in dog money. And the reason I tell you that is that that sort of makes my points. Expense is relative. The general fund budget for the entire state judiciary, and maybe you get tired of hearing this, is less than 2% of the state's general fund budget. If federal funds and special revenue funds are included, the judiciary share of the state budget is less than 1%. My guess is that you spend money putting sand on I-80 that costs more than the whole judicial branch of government. As head of the judiciary, the Supreme Court does all it can to ask only for what it needs, as opposed to all it would like to have. One example of that conservative approach to spending has been our resistance to the creation of judicial positions to staff the burgeoning demand for the treatment programs that are being called problem-solving courts. So in conclusion, as we look to the future, as I did last year, I'll tell you these are what we expect to be our pressing issues: completion of our building, keeping up with technological demands, continuing docket delays, the pressure to address and cure society's ills through problem-solving courts, drug courts, DUI courts, family courts, mental health courts, and the like. There is also a perception out there, and this is nationwide, I don't think it's shared by all judges, but there's some perception that our juvenile court system is broken. And finally, I believe Wyoming will take part in the national reassessment of the civil jury trial system. Again, nationwide, there's a fear that civil jury trials are disappearing because of the cost and delay occasioned chiefly by pretrial discovery. In particular, there is some thought that the pretrial discovery deposition, designed to guarantee jury trials on the facts without surprise, may actually be making trials too expensive for the typical litigant and may be causing the calendar and docket delays of which we hear so much complaint. So I'll finish up by telling you, despite what I said at the start, there's really only one thing wrong with this job. When I think about it, it's probably the same thing that's wrong with the governor's job and with all of your jobs, and that is that I had to go to at least 5 meetings for every one of those things I told you about. That's what the description for the Chief Justice job should be, is the guy who goes to meetings for us. As our court administrator has learned over the past year, I hate meetings. So I'll finish up. I'll tell you a little story about meetings. One of my brothers used to work for a state agency that I also won't name here in Wyoming. The manager of the office that he worked in liked meetings. They had meetings to write mission statements. They had meetings to prioritize goals. They had meetings to identify strategies. And they had meetings to schedule other meetings. The best one, and I think this is the day my brother quit, was when they had a meeting to try to figure out why they weren't getting any work done. So, inasmuch as this gathering is just really a big meeting, I'm going to do what I did last year, and I will shut up and sit down. Thank you.
Chief Justice Boyd, on behalf of the members of the legislature, I thank you for attending this joint session and for your remarks and your message to us. We appreciate it very much, sir. Senator Nicholas and Representative Simpson and Martin, will you please escort the governor and Katie from the chamber? Senator Jobe and Representatives Korberg and Hammonds, will you please escort the Chief Justice from the chamber? Please be seated. Mr. Speaker, I thank you and the members of the House of Representatives for being our hosts this morning.
Mr. President, I move that this joint session be dissolved. Mr. President, I move that the Senate be recess until 1:30 p.m.
Until 1:30 p.m.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move that the House be in recess until 2 p.m.
You have heard the motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed to it signify by saying nay.
The House is recessed until 2 p.m. today.